and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News special report. Iran retaliated today for the U.S. strikes on its nuclear facilities. It targeted a massive U.S. base in Qatar. There were no casualties. Security contributor Sam Vinograd.
Scary moment, but this is exactly what security officials have been preparing for some time.
And the U.S. was given a heads up by Iran, but Olivia Gazes reports the region is on edge.
Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, none of those have given us the sort of all clear, and so it is still an open question as to what this is, the extent of Iran's retaliatory strikes, or if this is just the beginning of them.
There have been celebrations in Iran and chants of death to America. Analyst Nahid Simadoust.
They're banding together again. As much as they do not like their own government, they would like to have a more democratic government. This is worse than what they had, imagined doing to bring about those kinds of changes for their own country.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Cammie McCormick.
As Wisconsin is brats on the grill for a tailgate, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For WFHR and WIRI News, I'm Melissa Kay. A new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum found Wisconsin gets less funding per resident from the federal government than almost any other state. The report, based on 2022 federal tax data, found that Wisconsin ranked 41st in the country for the amount of federal funding received per resident. In total, the state received an average of a little less than $15,000 of federal funding per person. While Wisconsin ranks toward the bottom of that list, experts are still warning that further federal budget cuts could have a significant impact on the state. A new study shows just how much money you need to live comfortably in Wisconsin. Now, it's important we define what living comfortably means. According to Smart Asset, that includes paying your bills, having adequate housing, and being able to afford hobbies, the occasional vacation, and a rare emergency. In Wisconsin, to make that happen as a single person, you need to make $87,000. For a family of four, it's about $225,000. That means Wisconsin is actually one of the cheaper states, coming in at 37th. The Wisconsin DNR is doing a study on one of the most popular freshwater sporting fish in the state. Brittany Merlot tells us which one.
Panfish. They started tracking their population in 2019, and now they expect to wrap up the study by next year. The agency is asking anglers for their experiences fishing for panfish, as well as helping with their own field studies. The goal is to better understand what environmental factors may be contributing to the drop of the panfish population and what regulations can be put into place to help protect them.
The food truck lot is open for the second Monday in Port Edwards. Trucks will be parked at 140 Market Avenue. The daily special will be there until 6 p.m., and Yum House and El Sombrador will be there until 7 p.m. tonight. I'm Melissa Kay for WFHR and WIRI News.
The Pirates come to town. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers and Pirates face off tonight at AmFam Field. Milwaukee with a 9-8 win over the Twins and a three-game sweep in Minnesota. The last time that happened was 1996. The Brewers now in second place, just 3.5 games behind the Cubs in the NL Central. The Cubs losing yesterday 14-6 to the Mariners. Racing, Alex Palou wins the Expel IndyCar Grand Prix at Road America in Elkhart Lake, becoming the first driver since A.J. Foyt in 1975 to win six of the first nine races of the season. NBA, Oklahoma City Thunder are the NBA champions after beating the Pacers in OKC in Game 7, 103-91. Say Gilgeous-Alexander, leading with 29 points, showing concern for the Pacers' Tyrese Halliburton, who suffered a torn Achilles tendon in the first quarter.
Like, I couldn't imagine playing the biggest game of my life and something like that happening. It's so unfortunate. It's not fair.
That's the Thunder's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Download the Civic Media app in the Google Play or Apple App Store and take us everywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
A severe thunderstorm watch has been issued. High damaging wind gusts expected around 60 to 70 miles per hour. Heavy downpours, lots of lightning, and hail is possible too, which could be up to the size of ping pong balls. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Right now, it's 71 degrees.
This is your captain. We are going to be experiencing some slight turbulence. Please fasten your... Oh, hold on. Just got a video of my cat.
Imagine the pilot of an airplane was as confident as you are texting and driving. Seems kind of crazy when you put it like that.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
The Trump administration arresting and deporting these supposed gang members without giving them due process is one of the steps to becoming an authoritarian government.
Dale, thank you so much for the call. And again, I second all of that. Bring them all back and afford them the due process that's a part of our nation, a part of this law, and a part of our tradition in administering justice.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll have on Alex Modorsky of the Nature Conservancy talking about the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Project and conservation around the state. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4. This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
We're going live, gentlemen.
From Milwaukee to Marshfield, where passion meets purpose and policy meets people. This is the Maggie Dawn Show.
It is this moment right now, and we need people that have wealth and access to step the hell up.
Get ready to challenge the status quo with a fresh perspective on the issues that matter to you.
We can't take this as a country to have a leader who is so ill-informed and we look terrible.
Breaking down the complex world of policy and politics with clarity, conviction, and just the right amount of fun.
You got a bad sandwich at your favorite deli. What do you do about it? We can talk about whatever you want to sound off on.
Lawyer, economist, and fearless advocate for the truth. Here is Maggie Dawn.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Is the United States at war? What constitutes war these days? What even is a declaration of war? Do any of these terms have any meaning? What happens next? So far this afternoon, though there has been a retaliatory strike by Iran against the United States' largest base in the region in Qatar, no fatalities reported, and most reporting this afternoon indicating that Iran effectively gave the United States a heads up that this was coming, which allowed interventionist measures to be deployed. In fact, the most recent reporting I heard this afternoon is that whether it was 14 or 19 missiles directed at the U.S. base in Qatar, not a single one actually hit its target. Apparently, one did fall somewhere on the, but there was nothing there. So we're very, very thankful this afternoon to be joined not only by my fabulous Monday co-host, Matt Rothschild, host of the podcast Wisconsin Forward that you can find here on the Civic Media Radio Network and wherever you find your podcasts, but also Mideast expert Elon Berwin of the American Foreign Policy Council, who joins us again here on this fine program. Matt, welcome. Elon, welcome. So much to discuss this afternoon. Let's get into where we are right now, Elon. What is the current status as you understand things? The United States engaged three specific targets in Iran over the weekend in cooperation with Israel and its military intervention and its fighting with Iran. What were those targets and why were they so important?
Right. So there were three targets, but there was one that really mattered. And this was the uranium enrichment facility in Fordo. It's in western Iran, but unlike the other facilities that were struck, those were Natanz and Isfahan, those were sites that the Israelis had already softened up, that they'd already targeted because they were above ground, they were lightly defended. Fordo was a different matter entirely. Fordo was right now, past tense, built into a mountain with uranium processes happening underground. And the worry was, among Israeli planners, was that while they were striking at, they were running a campaign to set back the Iranian nuclear program, they really didn't have the ordnance necessary to get at Fordo. And so the open question was, if the U.S. didn't get involved directly, if the U.S. Sat this one out while Israel was carrying out its campaign, how much could Israel actually set back the Iranian nuclear program if this facility was left intact? And the president, you know, gave his famous, you know, 2 week sort of general 2 week time frame, which he says sort of for everything.
Yes.
He'll make a decision within 2 weeks, but very quickly seemed to come to the conclusion that the only way out is through. Right. There, that neither the U.S. nor Israel nor Middle East security generally benefits from a job that's half done. And so he decided to attack Fordo, to launch, you know, to use the GBUs, the massive ordnance penetrators that we have in our arsenal, the Israelis don't have in theirs, as a way of amplifying what the Israelis had already done. The most important context, though, I think, for all of this is the president did this and the ancillary strikes on Natanz and Ford and Isfahan for good measure, really as an element of coercive diplomacy, as in this wasn't an attack to change the Iranian regime. This was very clearly, at least in my mind, very clearly an effort to reset the negotiation process, which had become stalled. And you saw the messaging coming out of the White House. You saw what he was tweeting in regular language and in all caps. He was saying, you know, we've done this. Now come back to the table. He's tweeted now. The Iranians, when they were contemplating their options, they really didn't have very many good ones in terms of responses because they could do nothing and they would be seen as provocatively weak by their internal opposition, or they could do something, and if they miscalculated, they could create a catastrophic response from the United States. So what ended up happening was precisely what we saw earlier today, was a punch that was telegraphed well in advance so that so as to minimize any casualty or any, frankly, any destruction of the Al Udeid airbase at all, right? This is, I see this as a face-saving measure on the part of the Iranians. It's not clear to me that they're ready to come back to the negotiating table, but it is clear to me that that's what the administration hopes.
Go ahead, Matt.
You talked about coercive diplomacy and Trump's tweets today, but how do you make sense of his tweet about regime change?
So I think it's all part and parcel. Look, the president campaigned successfully on this idea that he would end wars, right? He has no appetite for regime change. He does not want a nation build. It's very clear, sort of from my conversations with folks in the administration, this is just not on the agenda. What he does want is he wants an agreement that codifies the status quo as he sees it, that it has to be, right? Which is that the Iranian nuclear program is, if not fully dismantled, is in the process of being dismantled in a verifiable fashion. Right. And how my sense is, however we get there is how he wants to get there. And I saw that as a sort of I saw that tweet about, you know, make Iran great again. If this regime can't do a deal, then we need one that can, as a sort of signal to the Iranian regime that there is a possibility for escalation on the American side, that this his patience is not infinite. And, you know, there are consequences to continued intransigence. And by the way, at least in the context of Iran, this is actually a very useful messaging strategy, because the Iranian negotiating strategy all along has been to run out the clock. They did it successfully for a decade with the Europeans and then with the Obama administration. They ended up coming up with a deal that, you know, according to many, myself included, was overly generous in terms of sanctions relief. It was too limited, didn't cover enough stuff. And so the Iranians have sort of become conditioned to think that, oh, if we just keep talking, then the Americans won't do anything, right? We can only do one thing at a time. So what happened over the weekend, I think, really jolted them awake. And now Trump has signaled that, you know, the Iranian response was, you know, just a face-saving measure. He's willing to move on. The question really is, the ball is back in the Iranian court. You know, are they willing to move on?
Here's my question. I can take at face value the assertion, of course, that Iran is an overarching destabilizing actor in the Mideast, not a good faith actor. I think the historical record about Iran's what I'm going to just call bad faith, foot dragging, etc., pretty robust historical record there. The intervention by the United States, and we'll get into the legal authorities to launch this sort of military attack against a nation state versus a non-state actor and how that's become muddied post 9/11 largely. Yeah, sure. But my question is this. It seems to me that the question of the day, and one that Donald Trump is not really interested in engaging any dialogue about, is whether or not the attack by the United States, the use of these massive ordnance, penetrator bombs, actually took out Fordo, right? We've seen some footage. We've seen destruction. But the question is, did it actually completely right. obliterate that? Again, the president's word, obliterate, I believe, totally obliterated. What I understand from listening to a lot of military commanders is that prudence is what is most appropriate following this sort of attack until you have verifiable intelligence, complicating matters further, as I have heard accounts that, again, there were forewarnings of a potential attack, that Iran took measures to move enriched uranium, not quite yet at weapons grade, but near weapons grade, that it could be moved, that it was moved. So the baseline question, Elon, is the president right when he claims that Iran's nuclear sites were, quote, totally obliterated? Or do we really need, and again, Secretary Hegseth, Secretary of State Rubio, much more muted. And in fact, one of the generals said, we have to actually investigate that claim. Does all of this, again, how do we assess that? What is the prudent course when it comes to claims of total obliteration of their nuclear, those particular nuclear sites, including Fordo, the most important of those?
Well, look, so I think there's two things here, right? So we all have the sort of the lived experience that Donald Trump is given to hyperbole and he's given to exaggerating. But we don't, my rule of thumb is you don't take him literally, but you take him seriously, right? And I tend to think that that's right, that time will determine, right? There will be people who will be examining what happened to the enriched uranium, right? There's things like radiation footprints and things like that you can track by satellite, right? It takes time. But I tend to think that the Iranian claims that, this was just minor damage, we moved everything beforehand, is simply for their own domestic consumption. Because if you look at what the Israelis were doing in the days ahead of the American strike, their intelligence was so good that they were killing Iranian nuclear scientists by missile strike in their own bedrooms. So the idea that the Israelis could do that, but they couldn't track, hundreds of kilograms of enriched material traveling outside of sensitive sites that they have surveillance over, I simply don't believe it, right? That said, I don't know. I mean, my sense is that a lot has been accomplished, and maybe enough has been accomplished that the president is comfortable saying, you know what, even though we know that it's not fully obliterated, enough damage has been done. Maybe there's a little face saving that needs to be done on the part of the Iranians as well. Maybe let them take the sort of the hyperbole, let them take the quiet win and sort of move on, right? Because after all, he is trying to set the negotiating table again.
One of the quotes that I read over the weekend was from Rafael Mariano Grossi, of course, the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying on CNN Sunday that, quote, Iran has made no secret that they have protected this material. I've also heard that there are some mild way to put this, places of departure between American and Israeli intelligence when it comes to these matters. When we're talking about military operations, especially the targeting, the specific targeting of nuclear sites, specificity and the actual facts deeply matter, as does the accuracy and reliability of the intelligence gathering here. Can you speak a bit to this distinction? The New York Times reporting, amongst other outlets, that American officials have said that while Israel's intelligence agency believes that Iran can achieve a nuclear weapon in 15 days, the American intelligence apparatus believes that it could take several months and up to a year for Iran to make a weapon, begging the question about the legal authority for the president's attack. We're going to discuss the differences between American and Israeli intelligence, what that means for these sorts of attacks, and the question of the legality of the president's decision to bomb Iran. We continue with our expert, Elon Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council, and my excellent co-host this afternoon, Matt Rothschild. Keep it locked. The big discussions of the big issues continue on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
This fall, there's only one place to be, Camp Randall Stadium. Wisconsin football returns with can't-miss matchups, including Maryland, Iowa, Washington, and more. From the first touchdown to jump around and the celebration of the fifth quarter, experience the traditions and unforgettable memories that make Wisconsin football so special. Single-game tickets are now on sale. Lock in your spot today by visiting uwbadgers.com or call 1-800-GO-BADGERS. Wisconsin football game day starts here. We'll see you at Camp Randall.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. For the last few months, Governor Tony Evers has said repeatedly that he would make a decision about whether or not to run for a third term after the state budget process is completed. In a recent opinion column at the Recombobulation Area, I made the argument that the decision that Evers should make should be to not seek a third term as Wisconsin's governor. This argument is not one of ideological differences or policy disagreements. Tony Evers has been a good governor and has served the state well. This more has to do with Evers' age. He'll be 75 years old in November 2026, and about how the Democratic Party has had a massive, inescapable problem in its unwillingness to pass the torch to the next generation. Tony Evers needs to do what so many other Democrats have struggled so mightily to do and step aside when the time is right. And after Joe Biden's catastrophic 2024, this is a conversation we need to be having, and we need to be having it now. Democrats can't keep repeating the same mistakes over and over. It's time to do things differently.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
How serious is youth vaping? Irreversible lung damage serious? 1 in 10 kids vape serious? Which warrants a serious conversation from a serious parental figure, like yourself. Not the seriously know-it-all sports dad, or the seriously smart podcaster. It requires a serious conversation that is best had by you. No, seriously, the best person to talk to your child about vaping is you. To start the conversation, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Join the conversation with your favorite hosts or shows anytime. Find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Share your thoughts on our social media channels wherever you are, whenever you want. The Civic Media Network of local radio stations here for you.
Everybody, and welcome if you're just joining us on this steamy Monday afternoon here in the state of Wisconsin and for our listeners beyond. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. On Mondays, I'm joined by a fine guest co-host. His name is Matt Rothschild. You can find his solo work on the podcast Wisconsin Forward, of course, our state's motto. You can find that at civicmedia.us and wherever you listen to podcasts. Matt and I are joined this half hour by Mideast expert Elon Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council. You can check out all of his work at their website, afpc.org. That's afpc.org. Elon, right before the break, I queued up the fact that there has been some difference between American and Israeli intelligence as it relates specifically to how soon could Iran have a nuclear bomb ready to deploy. And so I wanted to ask you, the imminence of the threat, if you start to talk to lawyers who study the, quote, law of war, which is actually a complex set of both international treaties and our own constitutional limitations, and we'll talk hopefully a wee bit about that. But what do you make of that's a pretty significant difference, 15 days or maybe up to a year before they could have a usable nuclear bomb. What do you say about the differences there?
So, this is a crucial point, but I think the broader frame needs to be understood. There are differences about the timeline, but there's not a difference about the direction, right? Both Israel and the United States, both the intelligence communities of both countries are pretty much in lockstep that the Iranians are developing this. And in the context where you have these differences in terms of intelligence estimates, estimates of imminence, right? The country that's the most skittish is the one that drives the pace, right? The Israeli intelligence that the threat was more imminent is what propelled them to move. Now, again, it's going to take years, if at all, for us to see even the majority of the intelligence that the president right. has seen in terms of informing his decision making. But I'm pretty comfortable having sort of studied this for, you know, a quarter of a century. I'm pretty comfortable with the general directionality, right? We can quibble over whether it was 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever it is, but the directionality was clear. And the parallel processes that I think are very germane here is it's not just Iran's development of enrichment of uranium. It's not just Iran's development of a nuclear device, right? Because a lot goes into that, right? There's uranium enrichment, there's weaponization, and there's also delivery systems. Correct. So the fact that Iran was ramping up its production of ballistic missiles is also, right? It's not a tangential subject. It's also very important. So my sense is, again, right, like you, Maggie, Matt, I don't know about you, but I'm a recovering lawyer, right, as Maggie is, as you are. I teach international law. So I'm very steeped in this sort of this idea of preemption and prevention and, you know, the sort of the ambiguities that result, right? Under international law, if you stick to the letter of the UN Charter and sort of the letter of international law, it's restrictive in nature. Right. But frankly, so restrictive that it doesn't really meet real world conditions, because most countries do not interpret the right of self-defense as waiting until they're struck and then striking back, but stopping to strike back, you know, ceasing their retaliation as soon as the UN steps in. That seems like a recipe for, you know, predation by sort of more belligerent states. Right. There's a much more.
And yet it's the UN Charter, right? And the concepts of proportionality, these sorts of things, eminence, scope, absolutely. Scope of impact. What are the nature, scope, duration, right? In terms of right. our own constitutional yeah. framework. Can you speak to that a bit? Again, we've got Representative Massey now under massive attack from right. the MAGA side of the political sure. spectrum. He's saying, listen, we have an Article 1 crisis. Congress didn't even get notice that this was happening. What say you to even the baseline point that there was an obligation of this administration to at least notify members of the intelligence committees of both chambers?
So this is where sort of political practice and standards intersect with sort of with imminence and with the reality of politics, right? Because let's be clear, had Congress been notified, the news of this would have leaked, right? This is sort of the system that we're
well. Then why tell Congress with. Anything, right? They use skiffs.
No. Look, Congress has the ability and the constitutional duty to if this becomes a protracted conflict, right? Congress holds the power of the purse. They have the right to to bless it with the power of the purse, right? However, if you go back and you look at, say, the Obama administration, right, I can count on the fingers of one hand, right, the number of times, right, there was Pakistan, there was, the strike against bin Laden, all that stuff. All that stuff included episodes that did not involve prior notification for Congress, because sometimes surprise is necessary. So to me, it's not this one moment where Congress was not notified beforehand. It's how we proceed from here, what the balance is between the legislative and executive branches.
Fair enough. And Biden bombed the Houthis. So did Donald Trump. They did so without congressional authorization. My question is more basic than that. And that is, given all that has occurred in the post 9/11 environment, which is clearly an expansion of presidential war-making powers, however so defined, whether by the UN Charter or the United States Constitution, which doesn't have a clear definition here. And again, looking at how this Congress has wielded the power of the purse, what checks remain if These sorts of attacks can be leveled against nation states as opposed to non-state actors. Elon, we got to go, but will you come back and we'll have a legal eagle beagle afternoon
I would,
of discussing
I would
that.
Love it. I would love it, although I After try to stay away from law as much as possible. But for you, yes, absolutely.
Many thanks, my friend. Now, Matt's got some opinions. So do I, and I bet each and every one of you do. We'll convene the discussion about the Iran conflict when we return, not just after these messages, but at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. Get your thoughts going. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids Home for Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
4WFHR and WIRI News, I'm Melissa Kay. Online's not the only way scammers operate. Joanne Krulatz reports they can be found in your snail mail, too.
When scammers want to obtain personal information, they usually target online users. While being cautious of online scams, consumers should also be aware that old-school scamming tactics are also common. Michelle Reinen is with Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection.
We need consumers to be aware of those old-school methods, and some recent examples are letters. Fraudulent letters that consumers have received in their mailboxes.
Another letter mailing scam example involves a letter with a false threat to a consumer. Michelle Reinen says that there are ways to avoid receiving unwanted letters.
You can have a little bit of control on where your information goes if you ignore surveys and questionnaires and sweepstakes. The other thing you can do is exercise your consumer's right to opt out. Financial institutions are required to notify consumers of their right to not have personal information shared with outside companies. So you can opt out of mail offers and pre-screen credit and insurance offers. You can do that at optoutprescreen.com. And then you just want to try and reduce the total amount of unwanted mail you get. And you can do that by writing to the companies individually, asking them to be taken off their mailing list. But you can also register with the Direct Marketing Association's Mail Preference Services. And you can register for 10 years for just $2, and they won't share your information.
If you are a victim of a letter mailing scam, you can contact ADCAP's Consumer Protection Hotline by phone at 1-800-422-7128 or by email at datcphotline@wi.gov.
I'm Melissa Kay for WFHR and WIRI News.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Danny Boyle is back with the release of 28 Years Later, his long-awaited third installment of the 28 Days franchise. In a recent article in Variety, the Slumdog Millionaire Oscar-winning director says, due to cultural appropriation, he probably couldn't direct a film like Slumdog Millionaire nowadays, but says he's okay with that and that he would want a young Indian director to have that opportunity to tell the story. What a cool dude. Boyle's other credits include Trainspotting and 127 Hours. Timothy Oliphant is on a roll. The star of Justified has a new show on Apple TV Plus called Lucky, where he stars opposite Anna Taylor-Joy. But Oliphant wasn't done. He still managed to find room in his calendar to join the cast of another Apple show called Stick, alongside Owen Wilson. The Emmy-nominated Oliphant will next be seen in FX's Alien Earth, which drops in August, and he will join a new Peacock show called Five Star Weekend. Cha-ching. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
A severe thunderstorm watch has been issued. High damaging wind gusts expected around 60 to 70 miles per hour, heavy downpours, lots of lightning, and hail is possible too, which could be up to the size of ping pong balls. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Right now, it's 75 degrees.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
When Republicans try to be cute, they always end up looking like Wile E. Coyote in the old cartoons. Governor Evers is the roadrunner, and his veto pen is the Acme anvil that keeps getting dropped on their heads. If what they want to do over the next few weeks is not pass a state budget, it would be best for them to get one of those tiny cartoon umbrellas to guard against another Acme anvil that voters are going to drop on their heads.
Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pat Kreitlow.
On Tuesday, Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation Area has an update on what's happening in the Capitol, and Chad Holmes on stories around the Wausau area.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
Everybody. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm your host, Maggie Dawn. Hope you are staying cool this Monday afternoon. It is steamy out there. Folks, if you've got elderly neighbors, pregnant folks that you know, people with breathing disorders, please check in on your loved ones and friends when we've got weather that is this hot, this humid, and frankly, after a lukewarm, in literal terms, beginning to June. We've got a fine guest with us for this next half hour. I'm so pleased to have Patrick Faribault, the founder and editor of Our Lives, an online publication for Wisconsin's LGBTQ community. If you are interested in discussing the Iran conflict, the Iran bombs, the Iran retaliation, what comes next? Hey, is any of this actually legal or constitutional? Please hold on to your hats. We're going to open up the phone lines. We're going to go to that discussion at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. We're going to give all of you as much time as you want to sound off. I know my fine co-host, Matt Rothschild, has got a bee in his bonnet. We're going to make sure he gets that one out. So, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Let's just let's start with the tough stuff, right? Last week, absolutely terrible week with the Supreme Court deciding that states can basically ban trans care for young people. When you think about how to address matters like that in your publication, Our Lives, what goes through your head? How do you decide what the coverage should be? How do you speak to community when there's so many threats and they seem to be compounding daily?
Yeah, I think that one of the benefits of being in LGBTQ media is that I can speak from, or I shouldn't say not necessarily me, but the writers, the people who are part of the community and platformed by the magazine can sort of speak in community, where when like majority media or mainstream media covers stuff, it feels like it's almost talking about a group rather than to a group. So I'm able to talk to a group directly using the language and messaging and understanding to help communicate an issue, I think, more effectively of why it is important, the damage and harm that it can do, the lives that it impacts. And I try to do it in a way that centers the lived experience of trans people. I'm a cisgender person. I'm not trans myself. To make sure that they feel seen and valued and know that somebody's out there trying to protect who they are, what their identity is, and that they are valid in every community that they exist in.
What was your reaction to that Supreme Court decision?
I hate to say it, I'm just not surprised anymore. I expect it. I don't expect a good LGBTQ ruling to come out for who knows how long at this stage, given that there's practically a supermajority, or I don't know if it is technically considered a supermajority on the court, but Alito and Thomas have not signaled that they're willing to rule positively on anything LGBTQ. I keep telling people that it is literally a matter of time before federal marriage equality is overturned.
Really?
I think if I had to guess, 2 to 3 years.
Oof. Wow.
So, you know, and I'm pivoting from the trans stuff, so I don't want to diminish what you were asking about.
Maybe not at all,
the
Patrick.
Marriage equality stuff could be another topic later in the conversation.
The threat is really on all fronts. And I wanted to cue in on something that you were talking about, Patrick. And that is like the idea of speaking from within community, that someone who is of community can communicate in a way that, frankly, can bring people's threat and their vigilance level down. Their threat perception, their vigilance level down. Last week we had Abigail Swetz on Wednesday when the decision dropped, right? And that's an example of trying to do that. On Thursday, we had a group of fabulous Black female leaders on, and I tried to let them speak to one another, right? Mm-hmm. Without getting in the way. If you can unpack that a little bit for people who may not, pardon me for using this conceptualization, check any boxes. What are the ways that, for example, someone who's cisgendered or who is not a member of the LGBTQIA plus community can communicate to a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, hey, I'm a safe place, and you can talk to me, and how important it is to have mediums like Our Lives, your publication, that allow members of a community to speak to one another, that sense of safety is so crucial to create in these most dangerous times.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for the question. Like, one of the things that I tell people, and I feel like I almost oversimplify it, describing it this way, but if you think of like you're taking college French or high school French or Spanish or any foreign language, you have like 101 level, 102 level, 103, right? I feel like the way mainstream media covers queer issues most of the time is checking a box, and it never really goes past that 101 level conversation, which is great for exposure to wider communities to help people begin to learn that trans and queer people exist in their community and help demystify some of the things that I think the far right likes to kind of turn into a boogeyman around LGBTQ people. But it really is important to have a space where you can talk from an LGBTQ perspective to LGBTQ people. So you can go take that conversation farther. Like, when I mentioned messaging in my first answer, that was kind of what I was referring to, where you can actually start getting into topics that are like 102, 103, 104, that have that sort of that cultural competency baseline that just really wouldn't exist when mainstream media is trying to translate LGBTQ issues to who their audience is, where they're talking about LGBT people rather than to LGBT people.
And I think there's something to be said for those who consider themselves allies, consider themselves people who want to support and elevate different groups of people. It is really important, I think, to try to get past the introductory level of safe and respectful communication. I often tell people I never want to be captured by the limits of my understanding of how to communicate, because I hope that my intention always comes through. But I'm always open to be learning how to communicate more effectively and compassionately with people that come from different lived experience backgrounds. And I really appreciate you elevating that.
I think another important thing there is whenever someone from a majority group is speaking to someone in a marginalized group, the reality is you're more there to listen than you are to speak. Like, you have to kind of acknowledge that maybe it's not about you in that case, and listen to the other person and give them an opportunity to educate you on what that language is or how to speak about a topic, or maybe why some of the political and cultural positions have evolved to where they're at. You know, there was a great moment that went viral during the last round of anti-trans sports bills in the Wisconsin Capitol, where there was this really old school Wisconsin cisgender man, straight man, farmer.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Please continue.
He came in to support the anti-transgender legislation. And while he was sitting, waiting for his turn to speak at the public hearings, had managed to have multiple conversations with trans people there who were there to speak, obviously, in opposition to him. And, you know, it goes back to that changing hearts and minds. I think that was maybe his first time engaging with anybody who identified as trans, and very quickly got his eyes opened, realizing that the perception that he had just didn't match the reality that was in front of him that day. So ended up speaking out against the bills once his turn came.
Really? That's an amazing transformation in a short period of time.
Yeah, it was incredible.
I know we've got the audio somewhere in the files, Jacob. If you can check out Dropbox, because if we can find it, or just Google, I think it's like 82-year-old Wisconsin farmer man changes mind on trans. I mean, I played the audio because the man's testimony was so moving. Yes.
Yeah.
And he did. And here was the thing that I thought was incredibly empowering. There are two things about one, that minds can be changed when you are open to listening to someone else's lived experience.
Yeah.
And two, he got up and said it, and he didn't worry about saying it perfectly.
Yeah, that was another thing that I thought was remarkable. Like, I had watched that clip over and over. I was there that day in person, too.
Yeah.
But specifically, I would not... If you haven't seen the clip, I think it's easy to jump to, well, maybe this person's rural, but progressive still. I don't think he was progressive. I think he was probably at his core raised as red-blooded red as somebody can get. You know, the issue, I think, and what I've been trying to tell younger queer people now is a lot of the ways that these trans issues are being spoken about is almost a direct copy and paste of how the GOP spoke about gay and lesbian people,
yes.
You know, back at the peak of the AIDS crisis and then in the early stages of the movement for marriage equality. You know, they tried to use the same language, that pedophile language or that sexual pervert or all, to scare people. You know, when the marriage amendment back in 2006 passed, Fair Wisconsin had done a postmortem on why the average Wisconsin voter voted in favor of banning same-sex marriage. So, you know, to the point of enshrining it in the Wisconsin Constitution. And what they found out was the average voter that voted yes did not believe that they actually knew anyone LGBTQ. It's really easy to make a marginalized group, especially a group like trans people that are maybe 1% of the population, the boogeyman, because there's just not enough of them to fight back on that big of a bully pulpit that these elected leaders have.
But I do think more and more families are experiencing what it is to have a trans person in their family. And so the great nonviolent revolution that was the gay rights revolution is going to have the same effect with trans people too.
Absolutely. There's also like a movement, an in-community movement, where it's like, does the T belong with LGBTQ, right? And because one is about sexuality, one is about gender. And the reality is trans people were there for LGB people through every step of achieving any sort of legal rights. It's our obligation. We are tethered together. It doesn't exist without. This is our time to make sure that we're there for them. And I say that as a cisgender queer person.
And I think that distinction between sexuality and gender and what that means is the boogeyman that is used by so many is to conflate the two, right? And to not engage in some of the difficult discussions that attend to what someone's gender identity is, how it's defined, what our culture places as normative or sort of presumptively how we're going to define genders. Because as I said with Abigail last week, in every bit of recorded human history, there is recordation of transgendered people. Every bit, every culture, every corner of the globe, trans folks exist. They're in every corner of our communities, and they need to be loved and embraced and elevated, not denigrated and fear-mongered for some weird political end. We've got to take a little bit of a break. I'm going to be back with Patrick Farabaugh. He is the editor and creator of Our Lives, a publication that focuses on LGBTQIA plus folks here in Wisconsin. I got Matt Rothschild riding along with me this Monday afternoon. Keep it locked right here. We're going to come back, re-engage this conversation. What can you do in your community to help support the LGBTQ community? Stay tuned.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Tuesday, June 24th is the New York City primary, with 11 Democrats vying to become their party's nominee for mayor. The election also features two major democracy reforms, ranked choice voting and public financing of elections. Five independents, two third party candidates, and one Republican are also running for mayor, but are not on Tuesday's ballot. Nine candidates have qualified for public matching campaign funds distributed by the New York City Campaign Finance Board. Candidates for mayor must raise $250,000 from 1,000 contributors to qualify for a 9-to-1 match and follow disclosure and other rules. Mayor Eric Adams was denied matching funds due in part to federal corruption allegations. Voters will choose among the 11 Democratic candidates using ranked choice voting. One poll shows former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo with the highest number of first-choice votes at 36%, followed by New York Assemblyman Zoran Mandani at 34% and New York City Comptroller Brad Lander at 13%. Mamdani and Lander endorsed each other, and as the ranked choice system eliminates the lowest choices, one simulation shows that Lander's second choice votes could go to Mamdani, edging out Cuomo to get a 50% plus one majority. Polls are open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. We have more on the city's election, campaign finance matching, and ranked choice voting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Would you like to meet the authors whose mysterious stories keep you up past your bedtime? Tune in to Masters of Mystery on WFHR, Sunday at 9 p.m. As crime writers Katrina Monroe and Kathleen West join host Rob Young to discuss their writing experiences, the inspirations for their stories, and divulge the secrets that have made them award-winning mystery authors. Masters of Mystery is recorded before a live audience.
Look up cheese curds, you'll find this basic definition: wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, did you guess? It takes 10 pounds of milk, which is a big gallon jug plus a little bit more, to make 1 pound of squeaky cheese curds. Call me your curd girl for this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. Did you ever wonder, what do Maggie and her fine guests talk about during the breaks? Do they have interesting things that we don't get to hear on the air? The answer is probably yes. And if you want to see the secret show behind the show behind the show, then you need to watch us on YouTube on Civic Media's wonderful YouTube channel. You can also check out at Maggie Dawn Show on Instagram and Facebook and the X, and watch us there. And we've got a great guest this afternoon. It's Patrick Faribault, editor, creator, and writer for Our Lives, an online LGBTQIA plus publication here in Wisconsin. I've got Matt Rothschild with me, a fine guest co-host this Monday afternoon. Patrick, you were explaining something that I thought was incredibly important from the political lens through which these issues are addressed. And that is what? We were using this construct of knowing how to talk about, like, the basic intro is like a 101 level, and then you end up in like the 400 levels when you're in graduate school. Please explore that metaphor a little bit more, because I think it was quite apt.
Yeah, I think a lot of the media attention that go on to freshman congresspersons, you know, goes to the people like Jasmine Crockett. But Sarah McBride's also got quite a bit. Sarah is the first openly trans member of Congress. And there was a bit of national news when Nancy Mace was trying to ban Sarah from being able yes. to use bathrooms in the Capitol, which is its own level of crazy. One of the things that I found kind of fascinating, and I'm sure this can be searchable and found pretty quickly as well. In the past week or two, Sarah was giving an interview, a national interview, where she was talking about how one of the challenges the Democratic Party has done that I think feed into how the right has weaponized the word woke against the left has been that the Dems kind of jumped to trans 104 in their messaging, mm-hmm. right? That higher level. And the reality was, we kind of skip past trans 101 and helping the country just learn what like fundamental human decency is around trans people before we jump into the minutia about some cultural issues that are unique to the trans experience. Another thing that I thought was kind of fascinating that a lot of people wouldn't know is Sarah is a widow. She was married for quite some time. And her husband is from Wisconsin. Mm. I think her husband was from the Fox Valley specifically. But it's given her an affinity for this part of the country, and she's traveled here often. I've met and worked with her personally because of how often she's come here.
That's wonderful. I hope, Patrick, do let us know the next time she's in town, because I know we would love to have her here on Civic Media. We've got the clip of the 85-year-old gentleman or 82-year-old gentleman who attended the hearing for an anti-trans bill that was introduced in the last legislative cycle. He was there to speak in favor of the anti-trans legislation. But after listening to the testimony and talking with some of the people that were there to testify as well, his heart and minds were opened and changed. Heart and mind were opened and changed. Let's take a listen.
So, all right, Larry, the floor is yours. You got 2 minutes.
First of all, I'd like to apologize to you people. I was invited here to give my support for Bill 401. I have very little knowledge of gay people and things like that there. So when I came here, my eyes were open. I was one of the critics that sat on the side and made the decisions. There was only two genders. So I got an education that was unbelievable. And I don't know just exactly how to say this, but my perspective for people have changed. So I don't want to take up no more of your time. I'd like to apologize for being here, and I learned a very lot about this group of people.
If an 82-year-old guy here in Wisconsin can be humble enough to listen, can't we all? It still like gets me choked up listening to him talk.
Yeah.
Right? Like not perfect, but heartfelt, open, and humble.
I think it goes back to that expression that it's hard to hate up close, right?
Yes.
It's so much easier to have conversations about people who aren't in the room and create this perception or this narrative that just kind of dissolves once you actually meet and get to know someone who is marginalized based on however you're discriminating in, whether it's by gender, by race, by sexuality, by fill in the blank with any marginalized group.
Hard to hate.
I really
up close.
Admired his ability to, have an open mind and then to admit that he was wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just beautiful.
I'm sorry, like saying I'm sorry is so moving. We've got one of our frequent listeners and callers, LA Tom, say hello to Patrick and Matt. And what would you like to share this afternoon?
Hey, Patrick. Hey, Matt. Hey, Maggie. First, I actually own the gay and lesbian pages.com in Southern California. We are the number one directory in Southern California. And the purpose for it was growing up in Wisconsin in a small town called Durand. My dad being a head football coach, and he playing sports myself all the way through college. I was very, very close to killing myself when I was in college at St. Norbert when I came out. And I called one of the helplines, like we, you know, have the Trevor Project and things like that. But it was actually a hotline in Wisconsin. And I spoke for probably about 8 hours to a guy on the phone And he talked me off the ledge in terms of actually going through it and killing myself. And, and then when I moved to LA and moved away from the smaller towns and things like that, I actually decided to own my own directory that would actually be able to help people, with their process of coming out. But the reason I say that is, one, these things are so important, but one thing that's really important too for us in the LGBTQ plus community is to get out and just come out and let people see our authentic self and get to know your neighbors and basically go door to door. That's how we won with marriage equality. People started seeing us as actual, their brothers and sisters, their doctors, their lawyers, everyone else in the community.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thank you, Patrick Farabaugh, creator of Our Lives, an online publication for Wisconsin's.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News special report. Iran retaliated today for the U.S. strikes on its nuclear facilities. Margaret Brennan reports more than a dozen missiles were fired at a U.S. base in Qatar.
The United States and Qatar were able to be in communication well in advance of the attack actually being launched to prepare.
President Trump called it a very weak response, but Holly Williams reports the attack has many countries on edge.
Many countries here in the Middle East were deeply concerned by the U.S. strikes against Iran, even Saudi Arabia, Iran's arch rival. We assume that they are more concerned now.
House Speaker Mike Johnson today defended the strikes on Iran without notifying Congress.
The Commander-in-Chief has Article II responsibilities. They're very serious and important, especially in times like this. I think he used that authority judiciously.
Iran says the number of missiles it fired today matched the number the U.S. used over the weekend. CBS News Special Report, I'm Cammie McCormick.